I've just started recording because Max, you mentioned Matt Smith because
Yeah, okay, we can talk about the trailer.
we can talk about the trailer. Yeah, because okay, so just before I click record, you said something about that Matt Smith was the only actor in any of the Game of Thrones stuff that took you out of it. And actually,
Yeah, initially he won me. I mean, obviously he won me over. He's a great actor, but like this initial shock of seeing him in the show, like I saw him as the actor, not as the character at first. You know, took me a
Yeah,
little.
so we were discussing in general the fact that the casting of Game of Thrones is dominantly unknowns. Like in the main series, it was Lena Headey and Sean Bean were the only two that I kind of knew
Yeah.
vaguely.
Well, see,
Yeah.
sort of, but then you've got Mark Addy, who I wasn't super familiar with a lot of his stuff until he was in Game of Thrones, who also actually is almost the opposite of the Matt Smith take you out of it. He looks like he was in there, but Mark Addy has been in like a million like British films. You got Charles Dance.
Yeah, but none of them were like,
Who's the guy that plays
Game of Thrones was the exception to the so far the three different series of Song of Ice and Fire that we've had so far. That Game of Thrones had named actors, it was much less for House of the Dragon, and so far in this series there's been almost none. Matt Smith has been the probably the most actor reactor.
Yeah, in most Hollywood.
Most Hollywood. The most I think yeah, the most movie star of the actors. I think Sean Bean, even though he was so well known, he'd always had like a grounded TV route sort of vibe. So same with Lena Headey. Like I knew her from Sarah Connor Chronicles back in the day. Great series, loved it. But the fact that they could embody the roles and it wasn't you see the movie star first and then the acting second. Matt Smith, I think, is the only one that's really done that. And we were saying that potentially an actress who might have been at the premiere if she turned up in one of these series, it would be really taking you out the moment.
So the trailer itself, it was about 90 seconds long for the for season three. I'm just sort of rewatching it now, and actually this it doesn't give you a whole lot, right? But there is actually one thing that I did kind of notice about it. In King's Landing, you see a shot with, I think it's, Alicent walking through one of the gates, and they have properly got the banner of the green and gold, the dragon, but with a field of green gold dragon, which
Yeah, I
is
see that.
like it that's kind of interesting because throughout up until this point, Team Green has really gone in for we're going to look like the real deal. That's going to be like a strong part of our strategy is we're going to like take on all the iconography of like Aegon's crown, Dragon Pit, the blonde hair, like lean into that, the fact that he's male, all that kind of stuff. And then
Blackfire, the sword.
The sword as well, yeah. And but they on one of their more like brazen icons, they've switched the colors around, which seems to be a bit of a detraction from that strategy. But
Well,
yeah.
you need
We
to look different from the guys you're fighting, so you know
yeah,
which
I think
ones to
part of it is they're going with
play.
the legitimate quote unquote branding, but they're also going with the more palatable political branding. So they're high towers, they're going with the where the kind of the particularly because Rhaenyra has gone with more of a militant power, old Targaryen blood thing. And they're going with a more we're highly educated, high tower, genteel, proper seven sort of vibe. Going with the gold and green is kind of a softer messaging, maybe?
I suppose, yeah, because one of the things about the Targaryens, and we see a little bit of this in Night of the Seven Kingdoms, is that they're often seen as separate from the rest of the Seven Kingdoms, almost. They're not like, not like the others. They're not, like, integrated. They're still conquerors. And the dragons keep them in that position. But I suppose by adopting some of the colour livery of House Hightower, then it does make it seem like they're more integrated with Westerosi culture, possibly.
Yeah, because that was a lot of what they were, because they were going, so he's got the, I can't remember which crown he's got. He's got the crown.
Aegon has got Aegon the Conqueror's crown, I believe.
He's got Aegon the Conqueror's crown, but Rhaenyra's got her father's crown.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
But generally, his political thing has been more.
Also, Jaehaerys's crown.
Yes.
Jaehaerys's. Yeah.
Stairs.
I think I can see them going with a kind of softer, less blood and fire branding.
I suppose, but also from Otto Hightower's point of view, like, this is a power grab for him. Like, this might be the time for the Hightowers to actually start the process of you know, bringing themselves a bit more forward, not hiding behind the Targaryen livery and iconography, yeah, but also like
more progressive, less traditionalist.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it could be. Also in the trailer, we see actually Aegon, who I think, as this is 28 seconds in. So as we remember, Aegon, it has escaped with Larys the Clubfoot. Mm-hmm. They seem to be walking.
It's been so long, so thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I need to rewatch this series before it comes out.
Like, I'm gonna rewatch it, and I think I'm gonna reread these chapters of Fire and Blood, because it's been a long time.
So I think, I don't know if Aegon's shaved his head, or if it's because his hair was burnt off or something like that.
I think it's damage. It's like burn scarring.
Yeah, because I see some wisps of gold, so maybe it's just like...
Yeah, if remind me if I'm wrong, but he got burned by Aemon's dragon.
That's it, yeah.
And Aemon,
in the trailer, he says something like, the king has abdicated.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And also, so there's one guy with a Hightower, in a very nice-looking Hightower armor, standing in front of presumably a Hightower army. Yes, it's very. Is that Alicent? What's his name? Alicent's brother. I really liked him.
I think it was a different actor who played it in the last season, so it might be recast.
I hope it's not recast. It might just be a different Hightower. It might just be a Hightower general, new character in the series, something like that, maybe.
The thing is, I've just watched as my like filler series for the last couple of weeks, when I've been wanting something aesthetic and not really brainful. I've been watching The Nevers, which came out a couple of years ago and is Victorian sci-fi. It's fun. Mm-hmm. But it stars that actor. So when he popped up on screen, I was like, oh, it's him. Okay. That threw me off a smidge. It's not Alicent's brother as was featured in the last season, because Alicent's brother, as was featured in the last season, was played by one of the Foxes, as in the acting family.
They got 1,500 photographs here on IMDb, and they're all from all series. I'm just trying to see. I'm going to look at casting. Let's have a look at casting. Okay, casting. Let's see. Okay, Olivia Cooke, Steve Toussaint, Grandmaster Orwell, Kristen Cole. Do you know, I was thinking about this. Do you know what? I do feel a little bit more sorry for Kristen Cole through this whole process.
I think we've mentioned that every podcast this season. I mean, again, I need to rewatch the series to see whether or not our discussion holds up when I re-experience the show.
I'm looking at this now. Did you know, so is Gwaen Hightower is her brother?
That's from the one, yeah.
Last season, but there was a different actor that played him in season 1 that played him in season 2.
He was in season 1,
apparently. See, it's been so long.
I need to rewatch it and see whether or not they've recast, because it's quite possible.
So this could be the third. This could be the third Gwaine Hightower.
Why have we just assumed that he's going to be Gwaine Hightower? He could be any.
He's got a Hightower thing, and he's a young, good-looking, brown-haired dude. It seems in keeping with the general aesthetic of the Hightowers.
Oh, hang on a minute. Is there another Hightower? But there might be another Hightower. There might be a general, like.
He's... Yeah, well, one of her brothers was, one of her sons is off screen and hasn't appeared yet, correct?
Darren, I think he's been mentioned in the show, but they've never shown him. And yeah, he's in Old Town.
That could be him. That could be anyone. It could be anyone. I think they've got to keep Freddie Fox as I really enjoyed his time on screen, and I want to see more of him, especially with him and Kristen Cole.
Yeah.
Says according to the Game of Thrones wiki, it says he's in season 3.
There we go. Okay. Excellent.
So it must be a different Hightower, whether he's just a soldier or whether he's some other feature. I don't know. I'll have to rewatch seasons in case that actor has appeared previously, and I just didn't notice.
We're definitely getting battles.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't the trailer itself was a lot of like drama, battle, drama, battle, drama, battle. It is one of the things that I've forgotten how continuously tense and stressful and high stakes the dragon is versus I was saying the kingdoms. I was saying kingdoms are so cozy by comparison.
Yeah, I have to say this might 97 Kings might be my favorite show right now in the franchise.
I
100% agree. I was talking to I was hanging out with my sister's friends today, and they said, "Oh, what are you doing this afternoon?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to hang out with some friends and talk about House of the Dragon and Night of the Seven Kingdoms." And they were like, "Oh, I've never seen it." And I said, "Well, Night of the Seven Kingdoms, I can wholly recommend, and I will let you know once the season's finished. It holds up right to the end, but I can wholly recommend it. I genuinely think it's enjoyable.
It's the most accessible. I think it's definitely the most accessible.
So accessible. It's like it's got likable characters that are relatable, that live in a dark world, but it's not too cynical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's digestible. It has so much good stuff in it. House of the Dragon would be my second series to recommend, even though that's much less accessible. I don't know if I would recommend Game of Thrones to someone who's never seen it before.
To be honest, I
genuinely don't know. Partially because of the way that it's aged, and partially of the way that it ended.
It hasn't aged.
Me and Kelsey actually just started watching the show. We're halfway through season 1 now. It's her first time seeing it, so I'm very curious to see what she thinks.
You posted.
Yeah. I think it is a harder sell than it might used to have been.
It's also so much longer as well.
Yeah.
The three things that I would, points away from it is the ending, the length, and the... I've said this every podcast in the same way that we've commented on Kristen Cole every podcast in two. And I was Seven Kingdom, but I feel like each series they've learnt a lot of lessons from.
Yeah.
And I feel like the fact that they learnt a lot of lessons in House of the Dragon in terms of telling a narrative that was a bit more character driven and also had more perspectives from behind the scenes coming in terms of gender representation, in terms of racial representation, in terms of making it felt so much more like they talk to the people that the story might involve or represent a bit more. And then I feel like they've again learned a load of lessons with this season, with this series, with some Night of Seven Kingdoms. And so I don't want to it feels like it's evolved with each stage. I don't know. I really enjoyed the series. I think this so far has been my favourite by a long shot.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Genuinely recommend it.
But how do you rate this particular episode?
This particular episode, I had a few problems, I'm not going to lie, but overall, I liked way more of it than I'm going to criticize.
I think it served purpose for what it needed to say, but I think they had so much build-up to the battle, and then having the extended flashback as the, you know, a good third, if not two-thirds of the story, and that's great character work for Dump. I feel like it took away from the momentum of the sequence. Would have been maybe good to start the episode with the extended flashback.
Yeah, like that could have been jump
straight into the combat. Maybe
it was cool to see the, you know, the transition from, you know, getting hit to the flashback, but they could have lost that and it would have fixed some of the pacing issues, I think. Because like you jump into the episode, you want to see the Trial of Seven, that's what you're here for, and then all of a sudden you're brought back. And it is good character stuff for Duncan. It's really, I think, an important part of the story, and I'm glad they show that all. Mm. I just would have placed it maybe somewhere different.
Yeah. And it's by no means bad. I wouldn't rate this episode as bad. But
do you know what it is on IMDb? I'm actually a little bit shocked. 134,000.
It's like very highly rated. I'm
from 134,000 reviews. It's 9.6. I'm kind of in agreement. I typically don't like flashbacks. Lost really just soured them for me. I think they were great in Night of the Seven Kingdoms because they were little moments of recollection, which is perfect use of them. Because also, it's like there's a little bit of unreliable narrator, assuming Arlen's dick was, you know, maybe it was that big. I don't know. Like, it's not for me to say. But, you know, it's, yeah. But this, see, in the book, it doesn't last very long. So it's a short tournament.
It feels in keeping with a lot of, like, when I think of, say, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, it's a classic thing for a character to be knocked out halfway through a battle and then cut to, and that way you keep it really in the character's perspective, but you're not having to deal with the fact that, like, physical battle, even without injury, is incredibly, incredibly physically taxing. Mm. So to have, say, an hour or three's worth of specific combat, the most hardened warrior of all time would be exhausted and non-functioning at that point.
Yeah.
Kind of makes sense for you to be able to see the beginning and the end of a battle without having to worry about your central character doing something in the middle of it because they would physically not have enough energy. So it's kind of a classic to have a character knocked out in the middle of it and have then a character moment through dreams or flashbacks. I very much enjoyed this episode, but I did feel like there was a bit of a momentum drop. And I will admit that I scrolled my cursor along a little bit to see when it would go back to the boss battle and just accepted that that's a thing that would happen. It took me out of it a little bit.
Yeah, no, it took me out of it a lot. Also, all things considered, I didn't need his origin story. I didn't need Dunk's origin story.
I like seeing Sir Arlen. I mostly like seeing it for seeing how Dunk saw Sir Arlen through his perspective and everything, and how he grew to, you know, respect him and all that.
With Sir Arlen, it was a Dothraki hymn, I think he was singing.
Yeah,
that's what I heard. It didn't show that in my subtitles. But,
said it in subtitles. It's one of those things that I'd really like someone. I don't know whether or not any of the more educated YouTube people who do Game of Thrones analysis who know a bit more of the breakdown of Dothraki could do a translation. I'm sure there is a translation of it. It's the sort of thing I'd be interested to know what that Haka Dothraki chant.
I think according to what I've seen, it's like a prayer or a hymn because it's believed at this point Sir Arlen has lost his last squire that was like his nephew his or nephew. Something. Yeah.
Yeah, it was his nephew. I think he lost him in the Battle of the Redgrass Field, which battle that Duncan Rayfar looting from.
I was trying to look at that out because I had Blackfyre Rebellion and there was a Hightower and a Lannister back that I saw.
I'm not sure that's a Lannister. That's a Hightower, sorry.
Oh, I was trying. So what do you think was on the guy's...
Was it a Frey, maybe?
There's a the Frey is the guy that he's killing.
Is it a Frey? Okay, I thought that was a tower, but I wasn't 100% sure.
The guy that got crushed by a horse. The Green Banner. So with the Blackfyre Rebellion, all the big houses were on the side of the Targaryen guy, and a big chunk of the smaller houses were on Daemon Blackfyre's side. Not necessarily because of what they believed, but because they thought that if Daemon Blackfyre had won, they'd get rewarded for it.
Yeah.
And I think...
Sorry, I'm going to mute my phone. I'm so sorry about that. I'm special.
I can't tell. I don't... Is it like a lion or something on it? Or a horse? Or a...
Yeah, I thought it was a lion, but...
But on the green one?
Oh, on the green one. I didn't even notice the green one. I just noticed the red one.
Red one's definitely Lannister, yeah.
Yeah. And then I thought the guy he was killing was a Hightower because it looked like a tower on his thing.
The Freys do have a tower as well. They have the Tower Bridge.
Yeah, a Tower Bridge, which that made more sense to me because I was trying to think it didn't look like a Hightower sigil to me. I couldn't work out what it was, but if it's a Frey tower, that makes a lot more sense.
I think so, yeah. And then, yeah, you've got King's Landing in the background. And then, hang on a minute, do I see more iconography? No, I don't think I do, actually. In the trivia section, it says here, in the novella, Baelor has Dunk's team use tawny lances instead of war lances since they are longer and thus have a better chance of knocking their opponents off their horses.
So I wish they would have put that in. I wish they would have, you know, explained that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because all we see, you know, Dunk's shield exploding and then shanked.
I noticed the shield exploded. Like, after all that effort about getting a nice shiny new shield, the shield is immediately broken.
Yeah.
Yeah. It shows that the lances are different, maybe, but they don't really explicit. I wish they would have explained it a little bit more. I don't need to be spoon-fed everything, but just, you know, something would have been nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. After that build-up, but I suppose it also is, you know, it's real fighting doesn't hold up to your impression of fighting. The idea that he's got himself a nice shiny shield
doesn't
hold up to the fact that when you're actually in it, it won't save you.
It fucked when it got hit, but like if he had his old shield, the non-reinforced one.
Oh yeah, yeah, he would have been dead.
Dead, yeah.
Injury he takes is insane.
Yeah.
During the course of this, it's nuts.
He gets the lance in the beginning. He gets
lance in the stomach. He gets the blow to the head.
Yeah, the eye.
Cut in the eye.
Yeah. He gets stabbed through the hand and then stabbed through the thigh and then he gets hit in the eye.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he gets two, like head injury, a hand injury. Thigh injury, eye injury. No wonder he needed a little bit of an eyes open coma.
Yeah.
So, and that's on top of the childhood punk taking the sword through the shin as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
we got one line from Humphrey Beesbury, I think, just a throwaway line before he met his untimely end, well, along with.
That's just for bees.
Just for both of them.
The bee population of Westeros is declining at an alarming rate.
You like to say that as a cup of tea?
Yeah.
I wish we just, I liked that we, it was good that it focused pretty much completely on Dunk. Like, that was like the character story for the fight. But part of me wants to have seen some other, like, Raven Fossil. Like, we saw a glimpse of Raven taking on his cousin, but, you know, it's like some of that stuff would have been.
Yeah, I mean, Raymond survived, so fair play to him, right?
Like, yeah, Raymond didn't have a, he didn't look like he had a scratch on him. He looked like he fared the best. The warrior was smiling on him.
Yeah.
I do enjoy the fact that it's a double whammy because we've continuously praised how grounded and like character driven the story is. And so I wouldn't have expected them to do a pan out to show the battle from God's eye, as it were.
Mm.
And have like dynamic shots of different things happening. I was expecting it to be a very perspective based combat.
Yeah.
But also, I kind of wanted to see the smashy swords do the smashy thing with other people.
I wanted to see Lionel Bratton. Yeah. I think he must have been having a great old time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because you saw little glimpses of other things in the background. And it looked like some of the other fighters were basically running interference.
Yeah.
So that Dunk and Arian.
Yeah, there's a point. Yeah, yeah, where
get on with it.
Yeah, they're Baylor and was it Baylor and Raymond are holding Makar back.
Yeah.
From he's on my boy.
Yeah.
I will say what's interesting as well, as we talked a little bit about previous episodes about how Lionel is, you know, super fun and whatnot, but maybe he takes things seriously when he takes things seriously. And like his whole thing at the beginning about, you know, shame that, you know, your mother loved you, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, even though the content of that conversation was a bit kind of jokey and surrealist, he was taking it seriously. And I feel like when it's actual life and death on the battlefield, I think he, you know, he's doing the work.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it might be like the kind of thing where if you get too in your head about it, you're probably not fighting your best way. So for someone like Lionel to treat it as fun and games might just be his way of like a survival technique almost, or the way that, you know, he doesn't get in his own head, or that he doesn't become too tense or stressed, or, you know, any number of things that can trip him up.
Yeah.
But there's, yeah.
That's like both so much happening in this episode, and also it's a very like simple episode in many ways. Like predominantly almost no dialogue during the combat. It's probably the lowest dialogue episode of the entire series because it's most action.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a prolonged flashback and then combat.
Mm.
But that's not said a lot. It's just it's more of a vibe.
Mm.
It's a lot of emotions that are happening and not a lot of details.
What was quite interesting is watching Arlen, who, you know, probably been drinking a lot since the Battle of the Red Grass Field or whatever it is. Sort of, yeah, absolutely wankered, but at the same time taking out, what, two Kingsguard, is it?
Two Gold Cloaks.
Gold Cloaks.
Lower down the chain by a lot. And, you know, they were skeevy. And you get the impression that the fact that they're picking on to street urchins.
Yeah.
That they can't challenge up the pecking order.
Yeah.
And Arlen didn't come out unscathed. I think he came away with some cuts and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He watches and what it used to be.
Yeah. Mm. And I did enjoy, it was one of the things I was excited to see if it would come into play when they continuously showed the shots of King's Landing and slums.
Mm.
Whether or not they were going to do a combat in close quarters and how that would affect play. And I did enjoy the fact that like Sir Arlen's sword gets caught by the walls and everything. It's, you know, the fact that the close combat is not ideal.
It's good. Like Sir Arlen's, I don't know, he's a bit of an enigma of a character in a way, isn't he? Because he's like, he's part, like, old drunk and part noble knight, right? Like, he's got...
All men are fools and all men are knights.
Well, there we go. That's it, really, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. He's almost the Florian the Fool, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, I do like that allegories are held up in this show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, that's... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, the flashback itself was fine, like, you know, but I don't know, like, I don't know what else you could have had in this episode. I mean, I don't want to say that it was filler, but, like...
I feel like it slightly broke the momentum.
We are technically wrong on this. This is a 9.6 episode. We are.
I mean, again, by no
means... It was good, it's just really not perfect, like a lot of people are saying.
Yeah.
I think what I would have preferred... the storytelling is still absolutely excellent.
Yeah.
From an editing standpoint, having the majority of that flashback in a previous episode and then having a very quick cut version of that in this episode so that you can have it clear that Dunk is thinking back to his what happened when he met Sir Alan. At the point where he's stunned, and then it goes straight back into combat. But it's hard to say. Like, I think it's interesting as well, because we were talking about, I think it was last episode, we were talking about, you know, you could watch this as a movie.
Yeah.
I think if you were to watch this, like, all consecutively, like, full binge, like, not episode by episode, then I think the pacing would feel different. I think you could theoretically, I think potentially the showrunners are anticipating binges, even though they're releasing on a week-to-week schedule.
Yeah.
They're anticipating binge rewatching or binge watching for the first time.
Mm.
And I think if you are doing that for this show, then I think it would feel less step out of the moment and it would kind of roll differently and be like a breather after, if you were to watch episode 4 straight into episode 5, and you've got all of this build up, all this build up, all this build up, all this build up, all this build up, the beginning of the battle, pick it, and battle again. I can see maybe it's anticipating that pacing.
Something tells me that is a deliberate direction choice.
Oh, yeah. The reason why I think might be because of binging, like anticipating binging. That's the only reason I can come up with, obviously. Because in this episode alone, it doesn't feel like it feels like it's just getting started for the extended flashback. Well, I think if you watched 7 followed by In the Name of the Mother directly afterwards, I think it would feel more like a breath and less like a cut.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, I did like the transition back in where Arlen says, get up, and it's like, bang.
Yeah, that was great. That was a great moment.
And then he says it. He says it again, doesn't he? When towards the end.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, it kind of has its like. I don't know. It kind of has its return, if that makes sense. It kind of has its.
It has a payoff.
Yeah, payoff. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah.
Just wondering.
As a narrative reason, it's just, you know, it's a little awkward pacing. Awkward.
Editing. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Jenny.
I'm skipping through. I actually made notes. This is the first episode I've made notes for, and I was skipping around a bit. But I was going to say, I think, Max, did you say that it was the Battle of... What battle was it?
The Battle of the Red Grass Field, I think.
Who was the ruler at that point?
That was the last battle of the Blackfyre Rebellion when Maekar and Baelor were the hammer and the anvil.
Just found it interesting that there was Rafe, girl, made two references to the queen rather than the king. She made, like, the queen joke when she's wearing the helmet. And then later on she makes a reference to the queen's own brew for the ale tasting bad. And I was just wondering whether or not there was a significant queen on the throne at that time.
That's a good question. I did notice she said that, but I didn't think that much about it.
It was the fact that it was mentioned twice. That's what threw me off. I don't know. What was the presiding queen not popular at the time? Or was she just referring to the queens only because it's a girl.
Well, it might be the case that, I don't know, queens are known for drinking wine or something. I don't know.
I don't know. I did find it interesting as well that in, like, obviously, Blackfyre Rebellion's happening at King's Landing, and specifically, what's the name of the area of King's Landing that's all slums?
Oh, a Flea Bottom.
Flea Bottom. Like, Flea Bottom's still going to Flea Bottom. Even if it's wartime, even if people are bleeding out in the streets, it's still gold cloaks, like, you know, being mean to peasants, still peasants stealing stuff, still, like, it just felt very, like,
yeah,
the war's there, but it's not really, like, it's the smallest of folks.
Yeah.
Like, the war barely even affects them because they're so far down the ladder.
Yeah. I'm trying to look for the Queen's references, but I really can't find anything.
The Queen, Aegon the Fourth's wife was Nerys Targaryen, his sister. And then after her, Daeron, who would be the king after the Blackfyre Rebellion. His wife was Meereen Martell.
Okay.
Oh, Dornish wine. That's a thing,
Dornish,
isn't it?
Dornish wine, maybe. I mean, not that Rafe would know what Dornish wine tastes like. That's above her pay grade.
But they know that it's good. Like, as in, like,
it's foreign.
Yeah, well, it's like champagne. Like, you know, people who've never drank champagne know that champagne's fancy, right?
Yeah. Also, did you guys notice, so the I'm assuming it was a hedge knight that they hid from on the road. It was carrying, like, I'm assuming that's a squire with their dead master?
Oh,
Wrapped up in the body?
I was trying to figure out what that
like
their
lamb in a chalice.
Or something.
Yeah, like a sheep in a chalice.
I did not recognize it, and I.
So I'm assuming they're another, like, low grade hedge knight. Like, they don't have a name. That they're not a lord. They're a singular knight with a personalized shield. That was my guess for that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely not a big house.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Just, if you guys didn't know, then that's for me. I was like, have I missed something?
I'm trying to find it, but I don't find. Well, I don't know if my Googling is poor, but I can't find the house for it. I'm sure there are people out there that know.
Oh yeah, I'm sure the showrunners know. I have no doubt that it was. You know.
Yeah.
So much of everything that happens in the show is such conscious decision making.
Absolutely, yeah. They don't just throw in random. My suspicion is that it's distinct that it's a small house, ergo it's a Blackfyre squire. Mm,
yeah, presumably a squire and his knight.
Yeah. So so according to IMDb, episode 6 has already been rated at 8.
It's not out yet. People are just.
That be a pre showing.
Yeah, it might be It might be
early showing for reviews.
Yeah, so 9.6 for episode 5, 9.6 for episode 4. I agree with episode 4. That's excellent. 9.1. Yeah, I can agree with that. Episode 2, 8.4. That's a fine. Yeah, and then 8.2 for episode 1. Yeah, episode 1 was all set up, so I'll take. You know, I'm not expecting episode 1 to be the best episode. And since it's not out yet, that's probably just a placeholder or early reviews. Like, I can't imagine, you know, professional reviewers giving many things, you know, a 10.
No, on principle.
On principle, on scale, you know, like it's, yeah. But the overall, the show's a 9.0, which I think is, yeah.
Reasonable, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost perfect, pure fun, leaves you wanting more, did not disappoint, casting deserves an award. Yeah, like it's...
Oh, talking of casting, though, Young Dunk.
Oh, excellent, yeah.
Young actor casting. Yeah. Like, he looks like he could be his younger brother or the cousin of the leader. Like, the body language, just...
Yeah,
really excellent young casting.
Yeah,
I mean, a couple of times recently, I've been watching shows where someone's been cast as the other person. I've been like, that's a bit of a push.
Yeah.
But excellent.
Me and Rosie are going through the Star Wars films at the moment, and I got to be honest, the quality of child acting from small parts to large is not great. And I remember at the time people sort of justifying that by going, look, they're 10. What are you expecting, right? Some of them are younger than 10. It's like, and it's fine. I mean, you know, now this is pod racing. I don't
know anyone who could sell that line. I don't think that's a problem with the acting. I think that's a problem with the line. I don't think anyone could make "it's coarse and rough and irritating and gets everywhere" be a sexy line.
But then also, because we're onto the sequel trilogy now, and we're looking at Adam Driver be like a moody emo, and he is doing it so much better than Hayden Christensen. Like, he just is.
Well, he's just a better actor. Adam Driver's an amazing actor.
He is.
The script is also better for him as well. Like, the script for some of the prequel episodes, someone being able to sell those lines. If someone can sell those lines and make them Oscar worthy, then they deserve every accolade they can get.
Yeah.
Because, like, you're so beautiful, I'm only beautiful because you love me so much. If someone can make that line romantic and whimsical and not nauseating, I will give them a cookie.
But yeah, to be honest, the thing is with The Force Awakens, that I would mark it down for is it is too much nostalgia bait.
Oh yeah.
Too much Harrison Ford, sorry, but it is.
Still the best of the trilogy. It's still the best of the sequel trilogy.
That's where we're up to at the moment. So I'll report back with how the rest of it goes. But it could have done with more Adam Driver. Who's the guy that plays General Hux? He was all right. I liked him.
Domhnall Gleeson.
Yeah,
he's Irish.
The only bits I didn't really like about it were the bits that were like, oh, remember the Millennium Falcon? Oh, remember Chewbacca? Oh, remember Han Solo? Princess Leia I could deal with, because she kind of made sense in the context of it.
Let
me throw a spanner into this works a little bit. Can you imagine, would it be so much better or so much worse if D&D from Game of Thrones got their Star Wars movies?
Oh, God, it'd be awful. Yeah, like... No, I get that, I mean, I don't...
There's no reason why they rushed the last two seasons, right? Or, yeah. You know, it's a speculation.
Yeah. So they probably would have rushed the last two films as well. So, you know, fuck them.
Just like they ended up doing for the sequel trilogy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There was a mess made. And I feel that this is only from recollection at the moment, but the fact that the two different directors, Abrams and was it Brian Johnson or whatever it is?
Ryan Johnson,
yeah. That's it.
That just wasn't a complete vision.
Yeah, they didn't have a plan.
They didn't have a fucking plan.
And they wanted to go in two different directions.
If they committed to the choices made in the second film and followed through, I think it would have been fine. And I think the second film should have gone even more
in that direction. I thought Rey, this is way off topic at this point, but Rey should have fallen to the dark side in episode 8 and then been redeemed in episode 9. That would have been the arc. Yeah. But
I've always said as well that they should do, and they've never done, and it's always annoyed me, is they've got a pre-built evil in the world, in the universe of Star Wars, which they've never addressed, that is themic in every single film. Every single film skirts on it, and no film has actually gone, let's actually address this and deal with it, which is the intergalactic slavery of this universe. It's constant and it's rampant, and no movie has ever taken the time to address it in some capacity or another. So, like, obviously the prequel series, Anakin is a slave. Mm. He has all the issues that come from being a slave. His mum gets freed by marriage from being a slave. Bit of a question mark. There's all of that sort of thing. Then they, in the kind of predominant series, they deal with the fact that the Hutt still keeps it. We've got Slave Leia. Mm-hmm. We've got all of that kind of aspect that's coming into it. You also have the droids as slaves, They have like the restraint bolts, and they have the stuff that's addressed in the prequel, the Han Solo movie. Mm-hmm. They talk about droid liberation,
mm-hmm.
And then in the final trilogy, they have loads of stuff about child labor and forced childhood children. Were like child soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and like forced stormtroopers. They mm-hmm. have like loads of stuff in the other series, like the external series, about the clones trying to find freedom, particularly after they've like aged out of being soldiers or when they mm-hmm. become redundant, and what happens when that aspect of humanity has been, like, if you bred a race of humans to be part of war, mm-hmm. and then, you know, what happens afterwards. They have this inbuilt great evil which the heroes can face against, and they've never addressed it.
You see, I will say, I do think George Lucas did think about that a little bit with Anakin and his arc and how he, you know, like, became disillusioned with the Republic and everything.
He gets disillusioned with the Republic, but when he becomes Darth Vader, he then doesn't go out to Tatooine and stop the slave trade.
You're right, but those movies were already made by the time George Lucas had thought of that. It was too late to change that. So,
I feel like there was such a, they could have done so much with that if they wanted to, and they still
could have. Yeah, definitely could.
They'll do it at some point in the future.
Yeah, I was hoping that they would do something.
They do stuff in the Clone Wars or I guess Rebels with the clones, like you brought up. So that's something they do kind of go into.
They've never done it in a mainline film, and they kept going. Like in the Rian Johnson movie, they had the whole thing about the animals on the planet, like the
casino planet.
Planet thing, which was kind of dumb, but they then followed it through in the next film, having like, look, all of these animals that we've freed from this, you know, prison thing, and the theme we're running with is if we free all the slaves, then we can fight against the evil.
Mm.
Like, they could have followed that through. But they never did.
Yeah. And to be honest as well, a little bit in a more abstract way, we saw it teased. We saw the morality polarity teased a little bit in The Acolyte with Manny Jacinto's character.
The Acolyte is the one series I haven't watched yet.
I've only
seen the first episode, to be honest.
Star Wars catch up 2 years ago, and I watched every single bit of Star Wars content I could get hold of. So I watched Rebels, Boba Fett, I watched Ahsoka, I watched...
I like Ahsoka.
I'm Clone way behind. Wars. You're going to kill me because I still haven't seen Andor. So
Oh my God! Andor
Season 2 wasn't out. I watched Andor Season 1.
Okay, Andor is might just be the best... anything of Star Wars.
I know, that's what everyone says. That's what everyone says, and I know it's on my list of things to watch, and I'm gonna get to it. It's just Star Wars burnt me the hell out. Boba Fett is what the nail in the coffin was for me. That show sucked.
Okay, and also for The Acolyte, right? I think you'll like it, Max, because it's got some of the best lightsaber fighting. Going, and it does have some really good tense drama in the later sides of it, and Jenny, I think you'll like it for somewhat different reasons. I think it explores
the other theme, like the Jedis were basically taking child slaves, let's be honest. Like
they glance like, on that in Acolyte. Acolyte is a bit like that. Like Acolyte kind of has a little bit more from the Sith perspective.
Cool.
But also,
I did such a massive, like, I cannot tell you how much Star Wars content. It was when I was painting my backyard, like hand stenciling my back patio, and I watched.
Sorry.
So much. Oh, wait, for what?
That just sounded like an innuendo, didn't it? Was it stenciling my back patio?
Okay, I'll take your word on it. But yeah, I watched so much Star Wars. So. The vast quantity of Star Wars I absorbed in about 2 months. So I will at some point go back on Star Wars and watch Andor Season 2 and Acolyte.
I actually kind of feel that with Acolyte in particular, it's a lot more feminine for Star Wars. That's a weird way of saying it. But it's like it feels like there's almost like a bit of, I don't know, it feels like it was written for women, and not in a bad way, like I really enjoyed it.
But there's a different voice.
And it was written by women.
It was written by women, And also some of the Manager Kinto shots, like, come on, you know, that's like, there's something there for the ladies, you know, like it's all the gay men, yeah. So, you know, it gets a bit like, no, I don't want to say sexual, but it gets a bit like, what's the word?
There's other gazes involved.
Yeah. Like it gets a bit suggestive and a little bit sexy, I think. But I'll take
your word for it for now, and I'll let you know what's.
But it seems like it's a more feminine voice for Star Wars, and I think it's better for it in that regard for that series, yeah. And I'm gutted that they cancelled it because I'd love to have seen, because I think. I forget the name of the woman who's the showrunner for it, but she said that she felt that she had to make a lot of compromises in season one in the hopes that she could have more agency in season two to make the show what she wanted. And I'm just so gutted they cancelled season one. And I think it was to do with the fact that a lot of people were getting Star Wars burnout. And I think
that wasn't MCU burnout have been the thing.
Yeah.
They did too much. Them and Marvel, Disney came to them with a mandate, say you need to make X amount of content, and it just was too much for both studios.
Yeah.
They overstretched themselves, spread themselves too thin.
People just didn't want that much Star Wars stuff, you know, it's
There's only so much that you can have on.
Because in my opinion, none of it was bad. Like, it was all perfectly entertaining, you know, worthy of watching, in my opinion.
Book of Boba Fett could have cut the Power Rangers from Book of Boba Fett.
That was definitely the weak link. I will give you that for Boba Fett. But it was too much for normal people, and that was because the thing is with things like Ahsoka, even with Ahsoka, I think Acolyte got generally by many people better received than Ahsoka. The thing about Ahsoka is that it fits more within the Mandalorian universe a little bit better.
That's Dave Filoni's baby. That's his whole. That's his universe. His little mini universe is the Rebels Ahsoka.
Yeah,
spinoff universe.
And it's good.
He's in charge now, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's good hands. That's good hands. I like Dave Filoni.
Yeah, no, he understands. He loves Star Wars. I'll give him that.
He probably gets Star Wars better than George Lucas, to be honest.
Yeah, I would say. And it's, you know, in the way that it exists now, for sure.
Yeah. I still, like, to be honest, even the prequel trilogy are not as bad as I remember. However, Jar Jar Binks is worse than I remember. Like, he just gets worse on every watch. If they could ever do a remaster where they just cut out as much Jar Jar Binks as possible, or change it, just change Jar Jar Binks to anything else.
You have to go into watching the prequel trilogy with the Darth Jar Jar theory in mind. You're familiar with the Darth Jar Jar theory?
Yeah.
But can he, just on a surface level, can he just
make him less annoying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, because you're kind of right. Like, he does kind of hand.
He literally gives Palpatine total control.
Yeah.
To form the Empire.
Darth Jar Jar and the Purple Man Anakin theory make the world.
Sorry,
lot
what's the Purple Man Anakin theory?
So Purple Man is a Marvel character, a villain who push people, mind meld them.
David Tennant plays him in Jessica Jones. Very good.
Oh, I love him. I love that character.
I highly recommend Jessica Jones if you've not seen Jessica Jones.
Oh, yeah, no, I love it.
The Anakin theory part of that is the idea that Padme goes from a very capable, very strong-willed human being who is, at the age of 14, able to rule a planet and is voted in to rule a planet by age 14, and successfully does that enough that she gets two terms, and then she you know, it's a limited term for it. And they tried to change the legislation of the planet, try and get her an extra term because she was so good at ruling a planet in her teenage years. And then by the time of this third film, she's barefoot, pregnant, and spouting nonsense. And the concept that Anakin has been unconsciously, like, slowly seeping her will and slowly, like, basically breaking her mind unintentionally. And, like, the part of the reason why when she has the babies and dies, it's because of the reason why her will is so broken is because she's finally away from him long enough and outside of his sphere of influence long enough that she's realized that basically it's been not just a toxic relationship, but potentially a relationship based on an extreme lack of consent. Whether it, like, unintentional from his part, but still his will imposed over hers. And the concept that the reason why she believes, why she dies of a broken heart is because her mind was broken by the fact that she's had someone manipulating her will and ruining her autonomy for many years of her life at that point. And that explains so much of her behavior, but it's dark as fudge. Like, that's like the meanest timeline, the idea that it's been not deliberate, but has been
I mean, to be fair, Anakin did do a school shooting.
He did do a school shooting, which, you know, that's a pretty dark timeline, but, you know, the concept is that, like, the classic trope of he's a bad guy, but he's nice to his cat, or he's a bad guy, but he's nice to his wife. Like, if you then take away the one glimpse...
Well, he does choke her. He does, like, literally choke her. So he's not really a good guy to his wife. Like, we can definitively say that.
The exception, it's meant to be the breaking of his will. It's meant to be the final straw that, oh my God, he really is. It's been a systematic means of manipulation, abuse, and all of, like, if you talk about abuse red flags, things like taking away someone's network, limiting their access to others, taking away their ability to self-govern, all of these sort of things. It kind of ticks all the boxes of a really abusive relationship before it gets physical. So yeah, that's kind of the darkest timeline, but it explains so much about how this woman has gone from being physically, mentally, politically powerful, competent, skilled, knowledgeable, and then in the course of three films has then gone to barefoot, pregnant, and spouting gibberish and putting herself in an extremely vulnerable position for a man who in the previous film has to have, despite spending at that point a decade in the Jedi Order, the concept of democracy explained to him like he's three. Like, it seems nuts to me that there's that level of mental degradation. But anyway, that's the darkest timeline in Star Wars, and we're talking about a different night show.
Yeah, but also, honestly, that makes a worrying amount of sense. Because it's like they don't, I don't think they really explore why a Jedi is not allowed to have romantic relationships. But the fact that, because Jedis have the whole mind trick powers and stuff like that, and, you know, feelings of love can be quite intense and overwhelming at times and stuff like that. Like, the fact that a Jedi really can't be in
a real issue.
Yeah, consent becomes, can a Jedi really have a consensual romantic relationship? Probably not, right? As illustrated,
I mean, and obviously Anakin is extremely powerful. He's, you know, off the scale of midichlorians and all that baloney. But in doing so, like, if someone has got that level of power and such an extreme lack of self-control anyway, like, I assume a Jedi who spent years and years training and honing his craft from very young and whatever, past the point of emotions and all of that jazz, which we've never actually really seen successfully play out on the screen, because emotions are still a thing that all creatures have. Maybe they could then have a consensual relationship, maybe with another Jedi. But someone who is a Jedi and has that level of
or Otto, because he doesn't get done. Level. He doesn't get subdued by mind tricks. Like maybe there are certain.
Maybe we just all need to get along with
Watto.
Yeah.
Your only choice is another Jedi or Watto.
Yeah.
Like, what was the name of his species? I can't remember. Those only sense. Sexual, the only romantic relationship any Jedi can have is with them. That's
yeah. Or C-3PO. Yeah, so
it's a really nasty, like mean-spirited, abusive concept that explains so much of how gross that relationship is to look at from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's
also just as a side note, he is really far too intense. Like.
Oh, he's like, I would be creeped the heck out.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I don't know how it feels to look like Natalie Portman. Maybe people treat her like that all the time. If you're that gorgeous, maybe men just are creepy and intense all the time. Maybe that's how...
Just what you're used to.
So I think about you every day. Oh, I can't stand to be a part of you.
I know. I'm haunted by the time we kissed.
Oh, man, yeah.
Maybe that's how beautiful people exist. Maybe that's how they live their life, constantly having that interaction. Like, they go to the supermarket to buy oranges, and the person behind the counter is like, oh, my God.
I can't stand to be apart from the oranges.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's what Natalie Portman experiences every day. We should pity the beautiful.
But also, when we were watching the original trilogy, one thing that we did notice was that Darth Vader was actually a little bit more flamboyant. Like, he was a little bit more...
He's a bit camp.
Yeah, he's a little bit camp, and it was kind of fun. It was like, it's almost like Darth Vader liked being evil. Like, it's just like, oh, it's another day of just being evil. I'm going to strangle some people, I'm going to throw some people out of an airlock. Oh, it's going to be a good day today. Like, I feel like Hayden Christensen / George Lucas doing the prequels, just, I don't know, I think they lost track of what Darth Vader was supposed to be. It was like, where like, he's basically a mustache-twirling villain. And and I think they just, it made him too...
There's a certain level of, like, I can't remember who I was talking about. I was talking to someone recently about how sometimes you need just a little bit of camp to make something work. And particularly when something's foundation is a little bit camp. If you try and take the camp out of it, then you lose what makes it so good. And I think Star Wars is a really good prime example of that, in that the original trilogy has got a reasonable amount of camp in it.
Yeah.
And you tried to, like, in the early, like, the prequels, they tried to take out the camp, and that got replaced with, like, kind of 90s goofiness and 90s sarcasm.
Like, yeah, Home Alone 3. And then, like, you know, it had that, it's like, that era of, like, of family friendliness.
Yeah. And then, like, when it got to the modern era, like, camp is completely ripped out because that's not fashionable, that's not cool, that's not... like, aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah.
But, like, the series is based in quite a lot of camp. It is. It's just got that sort of, like, it's very hard to recreate it once it's lost. It is. It's useful to have. It's a flavour that it's nice to have as, like, a baseline within a show.
Well,
or within a series.
Yeah. We got Mandalorian and Grogu coming out, was it in May or something, haven't we?
I think I'm still a bit burnt out on Star Wars, but I'll catch up eventually.
Eventually, it's okay. You've got all the time in the world. That's a great
Mandalorian lost me a little bit, to be honest. I don't really...
I might venture into Stranger Things for...
Oh, okay.
Do Star Wars.
I still haven't seen the last season of Stranger Things. That's something...
I enjoyed the
There's
last.
Not seen any Stranger Things.
I enjoyed the last season of Stranger Things, but the last episode was just a little bit of a it was all winding down, and it was just a bit like. But it was good. I enjoyed the season as a whole. Excellent. The final season had some of the best moments. I'm not gonna say it's at the worst moments, but like, you know, the aftermath bit, the wind down at the end, the prologue. Yeah, that I think that went on a little bit, but I don't know. That's pretty minor criticism. It's good.
I'll watch it.
I'll get there eventually.
It's good. It's good. It's worth a watch. I think you'll enjoy it specifically, partly as a retro thing. I think you'll also like it, Jenny. There's like a lot of D&D stuff in there, a lot of D&D references.
Everyone I've talked to says, because I play D&D, I love it and it's a good show. I just haven't gotten around to it one day.
But have you seen, also, just on the D&D note, have you seen the D&D movie with Chris Pine?
Yes, I think we discussed this last week.
Yes, we did,
But yes, I have.
Excellent film. Excellent film. Probably, it's a better D&D film than Stranger Things is. But Stranger Things is nice in its own way. It's good in its own way. But, like, honestly, like, for a goofy film, that film made me belly laugh, like, a good number of times, the Dungeons & Dragons film. Like, that the weird kind of nerdy humor and the goofy humor, loved it. Loved it, really, really, yeah. Saw it at the cinema.
You have to give that a watch.
Obviously, it's like, what they do with it, is they kind of do it almost as if it was a campaign. Like, you know how with like Dungeons & Dragons campaigns, sometimes they go a little silly, they go a lot off the rails, sometimes they do a lot of that, and it feels very fitting to the world.
It's not just a generic fantasy movie with Dungeons & Dragons theme slapped on. It's
made by people who play D&D and know exactly how it feels to be at table. The bard will try doing something goofy and it will either succeed fantastically or it will go absolutely tits up and it'll be a fantastic experience if not very good combat. And there's a couple of shots that, like, there's a lot of very specific in jokes that only D&D fans, like, they've thrown in like a load of classic monsters. So you've got this place of beats and you've got gelatinous cubes at one point, and I saw both of those coming a mile off and was like, that's great. But there's things like the way that the combat is structured, you can see where initiative roles have fallen,
and
it's played in real time.
I like the bit where they got to resurrect people from the dead and ask them three questions. They ask them the first question, get the answer, and it's like, well, you got two more questions. And I kind of got to die.
I would have to double check the rules as written on that, because the joke, I'm presuming that it's the actual rules as written for 5th edition at the time when the film was written, is they hadn't actually done it as a concentration spell. They had actually done it as, like, they forgot to add that it's a concentration spell and therefore it is infinite, and that's where the joke comes from. Because I would suspect that it should have been a concentration spell. I mean, I've probably reached for my book now, but technically we're talking about a different night show.
Yeah. I still haven't seen it. But just actually going back almost to House of the Dragon, not House of the Dragon, the other one, Night of Seven Kingdoms, I still haven't seen Ivanhoe, but I found out this week.
I haven't.
That Ivanhoe invented the name Cecil.
Really?
It's just fact.
Yeah. The name Cecil did not exist before Ivanhoe.
I will take your word on that.
God, I hope I'm right on that one. I'm sure I heard that this week.
I have at work, there's a statue of a Cyril.
Oh, is it Cyril?
Cecil might be different. So, Cecil could well be reality, but if it was Cyril, then Cyril is an older name that has been around long enough that there's a very large statue that I pass multiple times a day at work.
Okay, maybe that's a fact, maybe it's not, I don't know. Those are just some words I said. They might be true, they might not. Hey, it's 2026 and the internet, who fucking knows?
Yeah, what's real anymore?
What's real anymore?
What's real anymore? I've been having AI training at work. Nothing is real.
Everything Hang on a minute. You're having AI training at work.
It's more to do with like how to safely use AI, like using it with using approved AIs with theoretically logins that have data protection systems inbuilt, and then like how to safely quote unquote use it. It doesn't really apply to my job role all that much, but my boss's boss. Is very big boomer energy, and he has been shown by a couple of the people who work in one of the other departments how they use AI, and now he's very much like, it's amazing, we should use this for everything. So he's getting everyone trained. And it's very specifically at the beginning of the training session, the teacher was like, hi guys, we're going to be doing this and this and this, and things we will not be discussing are the ethics of AI. We will not be discussing
we're just
the environmental impact of AI. We will not be discussing specific things. And I was like, okay, well, this is basically you log in and you type things and then the computer makes stuff for you, which isn't much of a training session. But also, I think it is important if you're going to be kind of almost sales pitching that this is a useful tool for us to be using and trying to integrate in our workload. You have those discussions about the environmental and ethical impacts of AI, because otherwise, conversation's only one-sided. Like, I get that you've only got an hour to train in some people who, I will say for a couple of my colleagues, big boomer energy. The question was answered multiple times, and at the end they put up their hand and asked questions which had been answered because they hadn't understood the answer. But also, like, need to discuss the ethical, moral, and environmental aspects of using it, not just promoting it. It felt really uncomfortable.
I gotta be honest, man. Boomers,
they love
boomers,
it.
Oh my god, boomers are difficult. I mean, it's hard.
I don't want to criticize them, but it was one of those things where, like, My boss's boss was like, yeah, this is great. We should definitely start practicing using this as much as possible. I've had a play around with it and we'll be using this all the time. And he was like, he was asking some very specific questions, which make me think. So we had a bit of a tragic incident at work 2 weeks ago, which I won't go into detail, but basically people involved are not English as their first language. And the way some of the questions that he was asking was like, I basically translate an email and send like a very complicated, emotionally charged email, but in another language, without saying as much. And I was like, please don't use AI to translate an email which has the content you are trying to communicate. The content you are trying to communicate, it is better said in person and then translated imperfectly by someone else in person than it is to try and get AI to translate the contents that you want to communicate if you are planning on doing what I think you're doing. It was just one of those, like, my brain screaming in the background.
Oh, man, I just... Okay, so one of the things that I feel like I'm a little bit alone in, particularly in my world, is that I actually believe that the younger generations, there's hope there, right?
Yeah, I really don't want to fall into the, well, kids these days, their brains are melting because they're not in this aspect. Like, and I don't think there is, but I think there is serious dangers to AI.
Yeah. But like the younger people, yeah, all young generations have had their problems. But honestly, I feel like it's the boomers' brains that are melting. Like, it's just like,
well, they literally have lead, you know.
It's all the lead, yeah.
You know, they grew up with lead in the gas, lead in the paint. You know, that's what I attribute it to.
Hey, there's a lot.
I agree with you that the kids these days aren't that bad. Like, you know.
On the bus, they're really polite from all different, you know, we've got a good number of schools there, some rougher than others. Yeah, sometimes they're a bit loud because kids are loud, but like they're all polite. They all generally on the whole have their shit together. Like
that's not how I remember the school bus, but I guess school buses are different in America because
kids. I was at a garden center today. And there was I'd have been 18, it must have been 17 or younger, waiter in the cafe, and there was a couple of younger girls at the till when I was buying my dinner. And they were absolutely lovely. The guy who was doing the table service, like having conversation, charming, very polite, really nice lad. The girl at the till, clearly quite introverted, doing her best, doing her weekend job, doing it really well. Like, she was saying the appropriate things. She was getting through her day. And you know what? It's great. And I work with 18-year-olds. Like, a lot of the 18-year-old guys and girls that we have in at the moment, wonderful workers. Honestly. Like, they're going to do well in life.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I think, yeah, it's the boomers I'm more worried about, to be honest. It's just like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to be too specific, but it's just like, man, it's It's just like I'm surprised how their brains have melted. Like, it's just, yeah. I don't know. Like, it's just like, yeah. I'm just I don't want to say nothing that can incriminate, like, not incriminate me or that can come back on me or anything, but like, oh man, it's just like, it's where the reform vote is coming from. Let's just put it that way, right? It's like, I just got to keep telling myself, it's not forever. We'll get past this.
We'll get through it. Very like patient. I live in hope.
I genuinely do. I know that. Also, one of the things that I genuinely believe this, and I think that more people need to sort of think about this, right, is that because of the nature of social media and culture war stuff and 24-hour news cycle, like, bad news sells, right? It engages the algorithms. It gets people watching the evening news, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, there are so many good things happening in this world on a daily basis, right? Renewable energy in the UK is at an all-time high. Well, like, wind power is like our primary form of energy generation now. We never hear about it because it's good news and good news doesn't sell. Violent crime, all-time low. Like, we never hear about these things, but like, there are many good things about, you know, the ozone layer is repairing itself. Well, not itself. We worked really hard to put it back on track. But like, you know, because there was some fucking dickheads in the canteen the other day going, oh, well, what about the ozone layer? They told us we should all be worried about the ozone layer.
Because they banned CFCs. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's why.
And it was a big international really hard effort.
It's the same thing in like the was it the late 90s and early 2000s, the acid rain worries? Ooh. Like, we don't hear about acid rain anymore because we sorted it.
Yeah.
We resolved the issue. As someone who dresses vaguely vintagey and or looks like a Victorian, whether I'm trying or not, every once in a while I'll get comments like, oh, do you wish you lived in the Victorian age? I'm like, no, every year gets better. Like, legislation gets better. Like, I have my own bank account. I have my, you know, most of my reproductive rights. You know, there's things like, I would not be able to live in my own house independently, like, at the age that I'm at, unless, I don't know, like, I'm a lace maker, but then I'd be living with, like, five other women.
Yeah. And also, you still need a man's permission to get a credit card.
Yeah. Well, or to get a bank account, or to get a home, or to get, a vehicle. Like, it's like, every, we are progressing forward. It just, sometimes, emotion versus logic are two separate things.
Exactly.
Sometimes it feels worse than it actually is.
The thing that always... The thing that really breaks my heart about human nature is that there is a relatively strong correlation between violent crime. What's the opposite of a correlation? Where it goes in opposite directions. Basically, the lower
bell curve?
Something like that, where it's like the lower violent crime, the more violent people think times are. So, because when you do hear about violent crime, it's more of a shock because it happens less. So you become...
Yeah, it's like a reverse trauma thing. If trauma's happening all the time, then it becomes blasé. And if it becomes, like, if it's shocking, then it's clearly a rarity.
Yeah. And if you match up polls to levels of violent crime, you know, it's like, yeah, the violent crime goes down, perception of violent crime goes up. Like, it's just, it's, I find it very sad. And I think part of it is the social media, the news cycle, all that kind of stuff, where it's just, there's so many incentives to disenfranchise people. And I don't know. I feel like we need it was a bit like Zach Polanski, make hope normal again type of thing, you know? Like, yes, we should, like, I genuinely believe, like, positivity is one of the things that you can use to fight everything that's wrong with today, you know? Not everything that's wrong with today, but, like...
Is that embroidered on a shirt?
Yeah, like, yeah. So, I don't know. That's just something, I don't know, I believe it quite emotionally. Like, you know, there's good things, there is hope.
There's good things in this world, Mr. Frodo, and
all, they're worth fighting. All the worst people in the world want us to feel shit. And it's like, like being positive is like a gen, it's like an act of rebellion. And that they actually talk a little bit about that in Andor in Star Wars, about like small acts of rebellion happening all over the place. Like it's like, you know, like caring for people and kindness and like positivity, not toxic positivity, but just generally like just helping people, being kind to people, lifting people's spirits, you know, lifting morale. That's all part of like, you know, the rebellion or the, you know, the resistance or just like fixing things. Because
I mean, it's one of the things with the American protests is the ones that have been most effective have been fun and weird. People are turning up in dinosaur costumes and dancing.
Yeah.
Like the ones where, yeah, like positivity is a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. And,
just like this show we're watching.
I think we might need to put in the title for this podcast, Many Tangents.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, I'm on board with the tangents. Like, I think that's...
Yeah.
I think the Star Wars conversation was well worth having.
It's absolutely, very,
very I think the positivity conversation is well worth having, but I think we definitely need to put in the title that possibly people need to be prepared for the tangents to be powerful.
Mm. I mean, all things considered, I don't even know how much there was to say about this episode.
I mean, I wrote notes, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, so no, yeah, let's see. Let's roll out the notes.
There's a line from the East of the Seven at the beginning about may the death sustain life, which is obviously meant to be a whoever loses this battle is proof, like basically that the death will pay for life, the Battle of the Seven is ordered to either preserve the life of the innocent or to prove the innocence. And then that came into play multiple times throughout the episode in terms of death paying for life. So we've got the Rev's death pays for Doug's new life with
Alan.
With Alan. And also the death of Alan Squire. It was kind of skirted around, but there's a shot where like there's some ashes being like dug up and pulled away from Alan's camp underneath the tree. And then obviously in the next shot, there's kind of a grave dug over with the helmet and some flowers on top of it.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing Alan lost a squire at least, but like he put a lot of care into that. And potentially that's why he was drunk in the first place, drunk in the town. Was he mourning the death of his squire?
Oh, yeah.
Then, obviously, like, the death of the squire is, again, paying for the new life. It's paying for Sir Alan. Maybe the squire's life was the cost of Sir Alan's life, and that's why Sir Alan survived the battle, because his squire saved him, and then Rafe's life was put down so that could join Sir Alan. And then similarly, obviously, at the end of the Battle of the Seven, we have death of the, you know, heir to the throne to pay for Dunk's life.
Yeah.
Dunk's life was spared because he died. Also, the makeup effects on the back of the head.
Oh, my word.
Well, effects, horrifying, excellent, gross, wonderful, hated it.
See, what was interesting about that particular scene, we all saw it coming.
Mm.
We all knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
It still
was a gut punch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he didn't deserve it. Mimi's also protesting.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't deserve to die.
Oh. although, there were some unhonorable moments from Baylor in this fight, wasn't there?
It's hard to know, because he said that the Kingsguard wouldn't attack him.
That, yeah.
You know, he's going in a bit heavy-handed. But then, obviously, it was his brother, he thinks, who killed him. It was his brother's mace. Like, that's, you know...
Well, his brother was probably the only one that could have taken a swipe at him. Everyone else would have probably been too scared, right?
Mimi's on the keyboard again. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if anything strange happens.
Well, she just wants to type her opinions in.
Yep.
You're right, yeah. The Kingsguard wouldn't, you know, go for him, and... Stefan was busy with Raymond's, and Darren's taking a dirt nap.
Yeah.
Literally. So Maker would have been the only one.
Yeah, and obviously between all of those as well, like the concept is obviously 7v7 is going to be brutal and chaotic, even if it's very clear who's who anyway.
Yeah.
So whether deliberate or accidental, like, we knew it was going to happen, but it was brutal. But yeah, I like the idea that he, you know, the thing is, him entering at all in some capacity is not honourable, because his position itself makes the battle an observed object. Like, the fact that the heir to the throne is entering melee against what is, like, predominantly the, like, it's the crown versus other people. It's you know, the person, the defense versus the convicting party, as it were.
Mm.
It basically, the lawyer defection, like, he should be on the side of his nephew and his brother, and he chose the other side. So, like, by the fact that he's entered at all, it makes it a really you know, there's a lack of honourability in the fact that he's theoretically challenging his brethren.
Yeah. Also, one other thing that I don't know if this is necessarily an honourability thing or a tactics thing, depending, I suppose maybe it's a bit subjective there, is because they use the training lances because they're longer. But
yeah, well, I don't think that was put into the text of this episode, because I didn't notice it. I think that might be subtextual or something. That Max, where did you get that information from?
Well, that was from IMDb, but they say that it was mentioned. Okay. It was mentioned in the novellas. I don't remember it, but then it's a detail that passed me by. But
I mean, obviously, like, they were going straight in for the kill, going for a lance to the stomach.
Yes.
And, you know, we do know that by nature, when they joust, it's not exactly, like, we know that there's been some joust cheating already. So starting the melee with joust, you know you're not going to be on a fair footing.
Mm.
But yeah, they came through swinging.
Although saying that, I'm just looking at the, oh no, that's Beesbury. It's kind of hard to tell. I can't see who, if Dunk's side. I definitely see sharp edges on the. Let's see. Oh, it's impossible to tell. On the show itself, it looks like they're both sharp.
Yeah, so they don't call too much attention to it.
Yeah, it's hard to find an appropriate shot, to be honest. So I don't think it's a detail that perhaps factors in here. But yeah. But apparently in regular tournament duels and stuff, they have blunted weapons as not to kill each other, but this is...
This was a trial by combat to the death.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did find it interesting, again, Jenny's costume moment for the week. So when Egg is handing Dunk the lance,
mm-hmm.
he's wearing what looks like his, like, underclothes, and then he has, like, a coat on when he goes to be in the stands.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed that.
So I'm interested to see whether or not that's just because, you know, if you're down in the mud, you don't want to get your, like, coat dirty, and then he put on his coat when he's up in the stands when he's with the nobles, or whether or not he's, to some extent, trying to hold on to his anonymity as the bold squire and the prince, so that if in future he then travels with Dunk, and Dunk obviously will have a certain level of renown having participated in this whole thing, or if he were to win the melee in future or whatever else happens towards the end of the series, if Egg then wants to travel with Dunk, then if he travels as the prince who is the squire to the hedge knight, that's not going to happen. There's no way that would be a thing that he could do without making them both massive targets for assassination, kidnapping, anything like that. So I think the idea that he's still trying to pretend to be a squire when he's down on the field and then can become the prince when he's with the nobility. I don't know how much that was a conscious decision or just a costuming decision. I do like the fact that his, like, underrobes have still got the red highlights. Like, he's got red highlights on, like, the trims of his, like, brooches or buttons, and he's got some red highlights around the trim of his coat as well, and then he's got his, like, overcoat. And I also like the fact that sequence where he's handing up the lance is somewhat similar but very different to Egg's self-training montage.
Yeah.
And a couple of episodes ago, where in his brain he was being like, here, take your lance, sir knight. And then the actual reality of it is, you know, Unk throwing up out of stress and then having to ask for the lamp. And it being like the idea of reality versus fantasy and this kind of, you know, the what at the start of the season for Egg is kind of a bit of a jaunt. It's, you know, he's gone off to see the melee. He wants to see the jousting. He's having a bit of fun. To like now it's light or death.
Yeah.
And it's hit home. And it's kind of this breaking of innocence. And it's a similar breaking of innocence to Dunk seeing his first man die badly, die of injury, die of wound on battle, versus someone who's presumably he's seen people die in Flea Bottom from injury or illness or age.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. But that was his first time seeing someone beg for their mother while dying poorly.
Which, interestingly enough, is the name of the episode, isn't it?
Yes, well, talking of which, I noted 5 different times mothers were mentioned in this episode for a non-dialogue-heavy episode. It's quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got Lionel Baratheon. He was like...
Lionel Baratheon, yeah.
I think that comes from a longer statement in the novella where he says, no one fights like someone neglected by their mother or something to that effect.
Yes. That's what he said in the episode.
Oh, okay. There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. So his whole thing about, the idea that, you know, the favorite child.
Yeah.
Favored child is the one that dies. The favorite child is the one. Favorite child of the nation, the favorite child of the audience, of Dag of Egg, the one that we all like.
Yeah.
Shame that the mother in this case doesn't favor him because he dies. Then there's the soldier who's dying, who's trying to say, well, he says Ma, but Dunk said he was begging for his mother. He might have been begging for mercy. It was hard to tell, but we're assuming that he was begging for his mother. Then when Sir Alan bursts out of the pub, he says, in the name of the mother, you won't hurt that boy, which, again, is another one. There has Dunk waiting for his mother, and he says, I know my mother's dead, but what if she comes back to me? And I think that's sort of Dunk's kind of concept of faith. It's not something that's really been brought up. They haven't really gone into whether or not Dunk believes in gods or the seven or anything like that. But the idea that he kind of had this concept of his mother coming back for him, or maybe his spirit, or it's unclear what childhood Dunk meant, because Rafe's just thinking he's being stupid and slow. From my perspective, it was more of a maternal figure coming back, or like a spirit or something like that. I don't know what you guys think on that whole conversation between Dunk and Rafe.
I find it hard to think of it as anything other than it's just tying it into the theme of the mother for the episode.
Regardless of themes, what does that character actually mean in that moment? What was he saying? Because that seemed a little bit unclear what his intention was.
Well, if you look at the mother in the context of the seven, the mother is what? The protector of the innocent? So,
yeah.
Is he...
My question is him saying specifically, I know my mother's dead, but I don't know if I want to leave because what if she comes back for me? Clearly, at that point, he's not talking about the mother in terms of the goddess of the seven.
No.
He's talking about his birth mother, one would assume.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Like, if he knows she's dead, why is he waiting for her? What, like...
My gut tells me that it's because he's just probably been told time and time again that his mother's dead, that most orphans, you know... Their mother probably died rather than them being abandoned or something, or they just assume that they're dead. It's just like, yeah, he hasn't seen his mother. He doesn't know where his mother is. He assumes that she's dead because, I don't know, maybe that's just the most likely outcome. Him. Yeah, or what he's been told, or what's happened to everyone else. So, but then she might come back for him. Like, it's unlikely.
Might meet his mother at some point. On a similar note, there's 2 times when characters are referred to as boys. So, like, Alan says, you know, you will not hurt that boy. And right at the beginning, it's green boys. So, again, reiterating the idea of seniority and childhood and mothers and that sort of thing. It was just one of the things I noticed.
Yeah.
And obviously at the end of the last episode, it had the 19 where it said to the mother to protect the young and the innocent. And a lot of this episode was about like the death of innocence and the idea that, you know, it's the first time Dunk has gone into battle and he, you know, he went in a green boy and has come out, I think, lost that, you know, battle innocence. And Egg has gone from being innocent in terms of believing that, like, he will just hand over his lance and to his knight and his knight will have a good old joust and it'll be a good old time. And now he's come back realizing that it was life and death and that sort of thing. And Dunk using Rafe as well as another death of innocence.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, it's not just protecting the innocent as in the people who are not guilty of a crime, but like the death of innocence for these younger characters experiencing.
Like a rude awakening, yeah.
And also the priest of the Seven King, of the Seven at the beginning seemed very young.
Yes, yes.
It felt to me like they didn't have a septum on hand, and so they just got one of the younger septums to speak on their behalf, because obviously it's quite a small kingship that they're in. I don't know. What's your opinion on that?
I don't know. I mean, it could be any number of things. Like you say, I think it could tie in with the mother of, you know, when you think of mother, you know, you think of looking after boys in a way. But also it could be Blackfyre Rebellion killed a lot of them. It might just be... Mm-hmm. That they just didn't have that many septums left.
Well, they just happened to have the only one they had on hand was a young one.
Yeah, yeah, it could be just like an, you know, it could be that, yeah, because like, if you look at that similar roles in the past, Grand Maester Pycelle, he did the one with Oberon Martell and the Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else? Was it like the beginning of? Yeah, it's usually It's usually the Maester, which is a weird person to do that, but it's usually them that announces the games.
Yeah.
Also, is he a Maester? Well, actually, that's not a Maester.
He wasn't a Maester because he was wearing like what was interesting to me is he seemed to be wearing like the kind of lack of a better term like backpack cape of backpack the Silent Sister. You know, he's got that kind of it was like a banner supported.
Oh, yeah. Like,
Or at least it was very similar to the ones that the Silent Sisters wear.
Yeah, like he's a monk boy.
A monk boy, which we don't really have them so much featured. Obviously, the closest we have to big religious figures are, well, it's like a supported, like, neck guard thing that's kind of very similar to what the Silent Sisters wear, which I don't remember seeing clothing like that at any other point in any of the other shows. Like, we've had the sparrows, but the sparrows don't have like the yellows and the blacks, and they're kind of more our reality monks than this sort of stylized religious clothing. That supported neck thing reminded me very much of the Silent Sisters. Sort of they wear like spokes behind their head with the fabric wrapped around it.
Yeah, like it's a banner that you put a flag in or something.
Yeah, but I think that's the first time I've seen a male character wear something similar.
Yeah.
It was just interesting.
It might just be a choir boy or something that they had on hand.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, he's got to be high ranking enough to be able to say the appropriate words, but
This is Ashford in the Reach. They're not. I don't know how many maesters they're going to have right there and then in the middle of a tourney. So he might just have been the best they had at the time, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was all very short, like, notice. It's all happened in the course of about 12 hours.
Something like that, yeah.
So I've only got a couple of quick notes left. One, Egg saves the day. Egg is willing to... He's watching close enough to be able to see Doug blink. That's, you know, the fact that he has authority.
He has some good vision.
Yeah, to hold back the Piper from declaring until Doug can get back up again. That's a good job, Egg, for contributing, but also that's kind of nuts that he was able to do that. I find it interesting that it establishes that Dunk didn't know the words to say over... Knight underneath the horse, and then never learnt the appropriate words to say over a fallen knight. So he hasn't got anything appropriate to say over Sir Alan. And then equally, kind of, he does say he says the right intentioned things over Prince Baylor, but he doesn't know the correct words. He said, you know, oh, no, don't go, all those things are the right things to say. Like, it gets the meaning across, but he's not saying correct words over another dying noble person who died. And I went back and watched episode one to see what he actually said, or like the scene in episode one where he's buried to Alan. It's interesting that he never did learn the words to say.
I mean, he doesn't seem to know words. Like, maybe he just doesn't have a memory for scripts. Like, because he doesn't know the knight's vows as well, which probably...
Well, I'm sure he's illiterate.
Probably, yeah, thinking about it. So...
Like, where would he have learned? Alan wouldn't have taught him.
Yeah, no, that's a absolute certain point there as well, yeah. And also, I think it draws that little theme of... He might not be the most godly man, you know, like he in the same way that
he's not smart, he's not wise, but he is big and he is righteous.
Yeah. So he doesn't know the words, but he sort of lives by them nevertheless, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like he's
My very last note is that I liked that the camp follower / whore is the one who's like, well, go for it, woo!
Yeah, she is great.
Yeah, and the fact that you know that she's sat up with the nobles because she's, I assume she was relatively low ranking as a camp courtesan, as a camp follower, but it seems like she might be more of a preferred courtesan. The fact that she's up in the stacks with the princes.
Oh well, she's with Dondarrion.
She's with Dondarrion, which, you know, even as a well-respected camp follower, that's still pretty high up for her. But I do like the fact that at least they showed that the small folks are on Dunk's side. And that word of what he is fighting for has come forward.
Yeah.
It was a good episode. As I said, the pacing felt a little bit off, but in terms of content, it was really well done.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always, like, I never really like flashbacks at the best of times.
It was the most extended flashback of the series. We've had quite a few flashbacks. This one really went on for quite some time. Yeah. It maybe could have been...
Why it was so jarring.
Yeah, I think maybe it could have been split up. Like, maybe we could have had, you know, Rafe, a scene with Rafe in episode one and a scene with the death of Rafe in, like, maybe episode three. And then maybe... At the point where Dunk's unconscious, it's the, you know, him following Sir Alan, something like that. Just so it wasn't so, just it was a huge chunk of the episode. Again, in terms of actual content, it was as good as the rest of the show has been, which is really, really good. Like, in terms of meaning, content, allegory, acting, set design, action, as good as any other in the series, which has been, you know, top tier.
Yeah. Totally with you on that one. So, yeah. It probably, I don't know, yeah. Flashback aside, loved it. It did very well, even though I fundamentally knew what was going to happen for the most part, barring, you know, a few details. They still made it tense. They still made it, you know, exciting to watch, compelling, all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, I will say they do need to show a significant amount of slow trauma recovery for me to buy into the world that's been established in terms of Dunk's injuries. Because between the thigh, hip, stomach, eye and head injury.
Yeah.
And the fact that when Arya got stabbed in the stomach, we're all like, that's so unrealistic that she would survive that. At least they had a line about, like, the shield would have taken some of the brunt, and they had a line about, like, the rings being embedded. So I don't think it's that deep of a stomach wound. So I can believe the injuries are survivable.
especially considering you've probably got the best, you've got the King's Maester on you, right?
Well, like, the King's
not
Maester.
The King's Maester, the Hans Maester, the Prince's Maester. A good Maester.
What I'm interested to see is the Maester, he said, I'll send the Maester to you after he's done with my brother, but that's the heir to the throne's duty to send it to him.
Yeah.
So I will be interested without Baylor to actually do the commandment. Sending the Maester, whether or not the Maester will actually attend to Doug. Because if he hadn't pre-issued that order, which from the structure of what he physically said on camera, it didn't sound like he'd pre-given that order to say, oh, by the way, Maester, once you're done with my brother, come and check out Doug.
Yeah.
Unless he gave that order, I think the Maester could quite happily say, no, none of my business. We'll see, there might be a level of honour to it. But yeah, I think we need to show that it's you know, wins for life. I broke my toe 5 years ago and it still hurts in winter. Like, you know, if I got stabbed in the stomach and hip and thigh and, you know, stabbed in the eye, I'm not getting up the next day.
I get up for next week.
I might not just get up. I just might just stay.
I mean, I think with Arya, like, it was definitely a case of, you know, she fell
multiple stabbings and then falling in the channels.
Yeah, right in the gut as well. You know, right in a real.
The other
bad
thing
place.
Is, like, they've been rolling around in mud as well. Like, there's a lot.
Like,
of, like,
impossible for it to have not gotten infected.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, but they were near anti-infection stuff, right? Like, whereas Arya was. Where did she go after that? To Lady Crane.
Yeah. Like, I believe that his injuries are survivable in a way that it's more realistic that they're survivable than at Arya's. But also, I do need it to be acknowledged on screen that it was not nothing. Just to make it very clear that the reality of the internal logic of the series is still holding true. So, talking of injuries, Sir Alan, there was a shot of him, like, lying on his knife at one point. Did he just fall on his knife while drunk, or was that an injury from when he was fighting the king's, the goblins?
No, he fell on his knife.
I think he fell on his knife.
He
said something like, oh, you old fool, or something like
that. Yeah.
Like,
well, I thought that was the case. I just wanted a second opinion.
Yeah. And I feel like it was sort of implied that he almost needed a squire to stop him from doing, you know,
stupid things,
yeah.
What I'm really looking forward to is once this mini-series is finished, going back to the beginning and watching it back through and seeing all of the stuff that's happened. Because just rewatching the first sequence with the flashback, with Dunk at Sam's grave and the flashback of, like, the you didn't hit me more than was necessary apart from it made him fall. Just after having watched this long, long flashback, it fills in some gaps. It's nice to, feels quite lyrical in the way the story is being told, which is nice.
Yeah, cool. All right, should we wrap it up there?
How long has this podcast been going for? How long have you been recording?
Almost 2 hours.
Right. Good job, anyone who's listened.
Good job. All right. Take it easy, folks at home, and we'll see you in the next one. All right.
Bye.
See you next time.